Okay, the last presentation will be given by Dr. Geyer on the cardiac data from NSAVP.
Okay, thank you, Neil. I do think that one thing that is apparent from the presentations today and the discussion that we've heard so far is that there does seem to be a consensus view right now that in a patient who does not have contraindication to a sequential AC and then followed by taxane Herceptin, that probably is the best way to go and will remain so for the time being. And that will be a substantial number of patients, particularly the younger patients. So I think it's very important for the medical community to understand the way that these therapies were administered on all these protocols. And I want to go over our B31 study, since that one is the most mature in terms of cardiac toxicity, and we have had a manuscript accepted for this that will be appearing in JCO in early November. So we did want to share that because I think clearly we need to give this as safely as possible. One thing that we are doing a lot of acknowledgments today that I think are appropriate when we're looking at this kind of a very, very substantial advance made really by a very huge community of clinical investigators and patients. But my role in B31 is a little unusual because I became very involved as a member of the protocol team more or less halfway through the trial. So I guess I viewed my job as to not screw it up more or less. And hopefully I did accomplish that, but I think it did give me an interesting perspective and an appreciation really for what went on into the design and development of the study. When the trial was set up, we had this very compelling data from the metastatic study about survival benefits, but we saw cardiac toxicity in a group of patients that we know had substantial residual risk with standard chemotherapy programs. So there was an agreement that it was appropriate to take this drug into an adjuvant trial, but there was a lot of appropriate concerns about doing it in a way that would minimize risk and also really characterize what was going on in these patients in a large cooperative group setting. We do have the highest rate of cardiac events in our study, and you know, it can be real. There can be a number of reasons. I think the thing that we as a group have to be able to be certain of is that we have done all we could to adequately capture all the events. And I think more than anything, when I got to the operations and biostats offices, I was very impressed with the extraordinary effort that went into this. There, you know, as people who participated in the study know, there were special data forms required that physicians and research associates were supposed to submit when cardiac toxicity was thought to possibly be present. But beyond that, a system was set up where we look at every follow-up form, every toxicity form, for any symptom that might have been related to heart failure. In case a site forgets about this requirement, we're on the phone calling. So I think we are very certain that we have captured these events, and I think that is an important thing for people to understand. And these are the people at the biostatistical office that have made that possible and will continue to follow these patients. So we really have not only the difference between the two, but also a good absolute sense. On our trial, you've seen the schema. The point I wanted to just make here is that the bulk of our data on cardiac toxicity does come in from the 3-week schedule. Since our amendment to allow weekly paclitaxel occurred fairly well into the trial. Another item that has come up with the manuscript reviews and a question I hear is this question of why did we say that 4% was okay? When the study was set up, the decision was made that as long as we had a 4% or less cardiac event rate, the study would be allowed to continue forward. And this is basically the reason. We were assuming that the trastuzumab would reduce risk of recurrence by 25%. We felt that that degree of benefit for this high-risk, high-recurrence rate population would be appropriate because that would have been estimated to improve 10-year overall survival by 8%. So a 4% cardiotoxicity was worth an 8% improvement in survival. The other thing that, of course, was there that helped also was the fact that the trastuzumab cardiotoxicity did appear to be largely reversible, which, of course, was important as well. Key item when you're looking at using the patient outside of clinical trials is to understand that in order to go into these trials, patients had to basically have no cardiac history and had normal EKG, normal left ventricular ejection fraction. And these are the eligibility criteria from the B31 study. Additionally, for safety purposes, the serial MUGA scans were built into the protocol in part to get a sense of the differences in the broad global cardiac effects of the trastuzumab added to the chemo regimens. But they also were used to make important management decisions, and I think because of that, they need to remain part of the standard practice. The first management MUGA scan came at the end of AC at 3 months, and basically that scan was used to see if patients who were randomized to trastuzumab could begin the therapy. And essentially, a patient had to have their LVEF remain in the normal range, and they could not have an absolute decline above 15 percentage points from baseline or the trastuzumab was withheld. When you look at our data in the trastuzumab arm, it was 6.8%. Interestingly, the control arm was a little bit higher, so overall this was about 7.5% of patients who got AC had drops in their ejection fraction to below normal, or at least 15%. So AC by itself does have impact on cardiac function. We don't see symptomatic heart failure often, but we now know that there is this baseline for these regimens. The primary endpoint for the cardiac safety portion of the study was to identify what cardiac event. As Denny mentioned, we had a little narrower definition of our cardiac events, and they chose to use an 006. Basically, what we were concerned about primarily was symptomatic heart failure, but obviously would include cardiac death as a substantial cardiac event. We did want to identify patients who had clear symptomatic heart failure in this figure. So basically the decision was made that these patients would have to have New York class heart 3 or 4 failure in order to meet criteria associated with documented declines in ejection fraction as shown there. Another important element of defining this was the real-time blinded evaluation that took place on the trial. If a patient developed symptoms that were suggestive of heart failure, even if workup ruled that out, we asked sites to submit a form CR within 14 days along with source documents. Those were blinded by the team as to whether the patients were receiving trastuzumab or not. And then the documents were sent to our cardiac advisory panel. We had 3 members who were familiar with the specifics of the protocol, 2 of whom helped plan the protocol, and a majority determination would then determine whether or not that met the protocol specified criteria. Bottom line to our data is we calculated a cumulative 3-year rate of 4% versus 0.6%. So there clearly was a substantial increase in this event with a hazard rate of 7.2, but it was within the parameters of the study. Another important part of the trial was an attempt made to try to see if there were factors which would predict for increased risk for a cardiac event on the protocol regimen. We collected a lot of information about baseline risk factors, and bottom line is none of those really predicted. There was a trend for hypertension. The things that did hold up in multivariate analysis were age as well as post-AC-LVEF. The cardiac toxicity really was quite prominent in patients whose post-AC-LVEFs were in the 50 to 54 range, still normal, but at the low end of normal. And in patients 50 and above, we had a 20%. The lower limit of the confidence interval there is above 10%. So in our data set, this is a group that went on to have significant rates of cardiotoxicity. Even the younger women still had a 7%. Those who had higher ejection fractions post-AC really did not seem to have nearly the problem. The North Central group has looked at their data, CIRG has looked at their data and have not seen that, but that is something that we have clearly seen in ours. In terms of reversibility, we are tracking these patients. Those of you who have had patients who developed symptoms that required a report form sent in know that every 6 months we're sending a query to update how they're doing. We feel like it is very important for us to follow up on symptoms as well as medication. And this obviously is encouraging. If you looked at the patients who have confirmed heart failure followed out beyond 6 months, only 1 out of 27 are still reporting symptoms. There are a number of them, though, still on medication to remain asymptomatic. So there certainly is improvement, but a number do remain on medication. One final thing that I want to mention is that it is also important to remember that you have to monitor the ejection fraction on therapy and to discontinue therapy even in asymptomatic patients. On our study, we used the Mugger results at 6 and 9 months to hold trastuzumab. If there were substantial drops, we would wait 4 weeks and basically get a confirmatory scan. If it showed that indeed they really had that low of a level that was persisting, therapy was stopped. Importantly, when you look at our data, you do see that all throughout the year of therapy, patients were having the treatment held. So, you know, obviously if we didn't see it out here when they were on the monotherapy, you might be able to say, well, let's stop it. But we feel like the fact that a substantial number of patients continue to be identified warrants incorporation of the Mugger scans and the same decision trees in management. Thank you for your interest.
One final question to Dr. Geyer to follow up his presentation. Practically, how do you approach the patient who's had a post-AC drop in ejection fraction?
Well, I think right now, if I have somebody down there real low where I think they might fall in our 20% range, I personally would give them paclitaxel and allow them more recovery time and bring the Herceptin in later, though obviously if somebody was just one digit below the cut, you know, I mean, they're... You know, we had to be very rigid where we said stop, start with our protocol, and there's always going to be those sort of judgments.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to our speakers and particularly to Dr. Norman Walmark and Dr. Charles Geyer from the NSABP. And thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Breast Cancer Update.